Yes.
Got to repeat that.
Okay.
All right. The E-12 Senate Education Finance Committee will come to order. Senator Wieger and the Senate File 155.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Division members, Senate File 155 would increase school readiness aid. This is focused in early education, a key benchmark for creating the world's best workforce. It's an increase of about $5 million. I do have one author's amendment. It's oral, but if I could call your attention to page 1, line 22, please delete 2015 and insert 2016. I would so move.
Okay, Senator Wieger moves on line 122, page 1, delete 2015 and insert 2016. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Senator Wieger.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members, I would ask my testifiers to join me and state the reason why this is needed.
Okay. Please give your name for the record.
Good morning, Chairman Stump, members of the committee. My name is Steve Brisendine. I'm the Community Education and Recreation Director in Wilmer, Minnesota. And I thank you for the opportunity to be here and testify on behalf of Senate File 155, Increasing Aid for School Readiness Programming. Wilmer is a unique community 100 miles west of here, a regional center in west central Minnesota that has urban issues. Our current school readiness program is serving 144 students, 102 four-year-olds, and 42 three-year-olds through our school-based programming. 70% of these students qualify for scholarships based on free and reduced data. These scholarships come in the form of Pathway 1, Pathway 2, local resources from the United Way, and our community education program to assist students to access our programs. 53% of the students we are serving come from diversity, mostly East African and Latino cultures, with the number of cultures increasing in our community on a weekly basis. We are blessed to be able to deliver these services to our students because of the past initiatives that have created more early education opportunities and resources in our community as well as statewide. We thank you for the past increase this current school year. It has been very helpful for us as a school-based program to lead early education initiatives in Wilmer and our area. We do not pretend to be able to do this work alone. We have many partners to deliver the services that we've got. The school readiness aid resources that we currently get in our school district had been in the amount of about $63,000 for the last 20 years. With the increase this year, it increased our local amount to just about $80,000. That has helped us lead our community, create collaborations, provide services with the assistance of a full-time early education coordinator and a community engagement specialist that get out into the public and work with our other partners, private preschools, Head Start, private daycares, and other providers to try to allow us to align curriculum, align assessments, and collect data to provide us with the best opportunities and the best curriculums to deliver to our children. We have been able to blend funding in Wilmer because of our regional status and the demographic area that we serve. We're much more fortunate than many of our partners that I call the acronym schools out in our neck of the woods. Many collaborative partnerships with them assist, but they are very small in numbers. Many of them average about 100 students per grade and do not have the services to provide the early education opportunities that a community the size of Wilmer does. An increase such as Senate File 155 provides would allow them those resources to continue the great work that they're doing in their small communities as well. I guess the bottom line, we in Wilmer have been able to blend all the opportunities that we have with the Pathways 1, Pathways 2 scholarship dollars, with our local school readiness aid, with other resources that we've got through our Wilmer Children's Cabinet, that is a collaboration of businesses, United Way, Head Start, private preschools, and other providers, to deliver services that we think are outstanding. We'll show the data that we will have our children ready for kindergarten, be able to read by grade level and grade three, and resources such as this through Senate File 155 are the way we're going to get there. Thank you very much, and I'd stand for questions after Mr. Kerr.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Is it
Brizendine.
Brizendine, okay, thank you. Mr. Kerr?
My name is Steve Kerr. I'm the Executive Director for Community and Government Relations for the Anoka-Hennepin School District. If I might, just a little bit for the committee. The school readiness statute is what I consider a good, solid public policy framework for us to work with our early learners. And the reason I say that, currently we're serving about 29,000 students, 3 to 5 year olds, across the state of Minnesota. About two-thirds of those would be four-year-olds. The majority of the remainder are three-year-olds, but there are a few fives who haven't started kindergarten yet. One of the things I like about it from a policy framework standpoint, it allows if as a school district you have enough critical mass in students to have the funding, you can provide your own program. And in many parts of our state, it also allows local programs to use the same funding as a form of a scholarship to place students in quality early learning environments such as Head Start, quality preschool programs, those kinds of things. And they work with those providers to make sure that those environments are solid and of high quality. So I like it as a public policy framework in that it allows, with the great diversity we see in our school districts across the state of Minnesota, it provides some options for our local school districts to respond to those kinds of issues that they see. And I think Mr. Brizendine talked about some of those things. Also, as a committee, I believe was the first year that we've had a funding increase in school readiness since its inception in 1991. We appreciate that, and I sometimes joke that if we weren't doing collaborative work with our local communities using and blending funding streams, we'd have fallen off the face of the map long ago unless we'd have won two or three lotteries in between, because we would not have been able to fight off the impact of inflation. So by the fact of the matter is we've had to blend a lot of funding streams to do that. We also, the nature of the statute asks us to focus on students who would be at risk from learning perspective, and allows and prescribes some fairly specific things for us to look for as a district, but we also have local options as we come across and see children in our area, because our staff, we use across the state of Minnesota, about 97% of the staff are licensed staff. It allows us then, because those staff are trained in normal child development processes, if they see something in a child that is not quite where they think it should be, we can refer those students to some of our programs. The other benefit for us being in school district programs is we have the benefit of other kind of student support services when students have mental health issues, when we're trying to align our curriculum pre-K through 12, all those kinds of things that are beneficial are some of the reasons I like this particular statute and how it works for school districts. Let me talk to you about the Anoka-Hennepin story. In our case, a few years back when the literacy aid, actually, I think the commissioner referenced it, but when the district received the literacy aid, myself and some of the administration approached the board and asked them to consider some investment as an early learning as a place to go. We're better to go to try to impact the achievement gap. And so we used and dedicated some of our funds for that purpose to impact that. And so what we did is created an intensive four-year-old program. And by that I mean it's supported with transportation, because we found that without transportation, these families didn't have the attendance that we needed from them in order for them to move ahead in terms of addressing the achievement gap. It also allowed us to increase the number of days per week and the number of days that we offered services throughout the year. So we have those kids coming in. It's about 300 of those kids. Overall, in our school readiness program in Anoka-Hennepin, we serve about 1,200 students. There's 300 of them in this very intensive service, and these would be the kids most at risk of not starting kindergarten with their peers. Our success story, which I usually start earlier in my message to you, but our success story is this. After several years of doing this, I think our third year now, we're finding that 90% of those kids who participate in this program are kindergarten ready. Okay? The other thing that, and I've shared this data with you before, what I like to see is, are we making system change? Some of the things I'm finding is, last year, you know, Kennepin School District had to raise its entry benchmarks because we're pushing through such a large cohort of kids. It's impacting the benchmarks that we had for entry benchmarks, and they now had to raise because there's a larger group coming through. The kindergarten teachers have had to re-engineer their instruction because the kids are coming through. There's so many of them coming through, they're having to change the way they're teaching in their classrooms in order to maintain the trajectory of these students moving forward. And we're having to do that with our first grade teachers. Another data point I gave, I pulled how our kids were doing from a couple of years ago to see what their exit scores were from kindergarten. As a group, they're with their peers. That's nice. So then I'm looking at to say, okay, how are they doing in relation to a similar economic? So these are all free and reduced EL or students with special learning needs. We compared just the free and reduced comparison to look to see how they were performing. In math, they're performing 13% higher than a similar socioeconomic group. In reading, it's about 9 to 9.5% higher. Does that make a difference in a system? Huge. Huge if you don't have to do some of those interventions with those students. It's just a huge impact. So those dollars then can be directed in other places in the system in order to address student needs. So that's the benefit of why you do these things, and those are some of the successes that we are having in Anoka-Hennepin with that. That happens through a process of integrating curriculum, making sure that we've trained our staff well. And in our case, what we did is put all of our early learning supervisors and all of our principals, or elementary principals, through the Minnesota Principals Academy, so they're all talking on the same page, talking about the same issues. We're tracking our curriculum back through pre-K through 3 to make sure there's alignment and discussion and expectations about entry points and exit points for those students coming in and going out. And we are having some success with that. I think that's the magic story is here. We're having success. There is no bad news here. It's working well for us. Probably our only issue in reference to Anoka-Hennepin, we would estimate we probably have about 900 kids per age group. So I'm serving 300 in this intensive setting. We would guess there's about the population for a four-year-old group, for example, and it'd be similar with the three-year-olds. There's about there's 900 kids in each of those age groups that would potentially be at risk of learning from our experience. So with that, I would stand for questions, Senator Wieger and Senator Stone.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kerr. Mr. Kroonquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Scott Kroonquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and I'll be brief because I cannot match the expertise of Mr. Kerr or Mr. Brizendine, but we do want to add our support and our thanks to Senator Wieger for bringing this forward. We think the school readiness program is really one of the most unheralded programs and best-kept secrets that we have in the state of Minnesota, and as the two experts you just heard from laid out, they are having tremendous success and results in moving students forward and having students that otherwise would likely not be ready for kindergarten, ready for kindergarten. And in fact, having so much success that, as Mr. Kerr pointed out, they're actually having to adjust the curriculum and raise the benchmarks to accommodate where these kids are entering. So we think it's a great option. There's been a lot of great discussion already. And this is an option that we just think you should have on the table as we work towards a possible vision of universal pre-K. And we're glad you're having those discussions. We realize, though, that is not a proposal that comes without significant cost. And so maybe this is an avenue that we can use to work towards that greater goal. So with that, I'll stop. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Kerr, and, you know that I represent the Anoka-Hennepin School District, and I'm very pleased with the information that they are willing and able to present to me when they come forward with some of their requests. I noticed it today, and I want to comment about it and ask you to maybe expand a little bit about when you decided that transportation for the four-year-olds was necessary in order for the school to do what they wanted to do. And it wasn't a mandate from the legislature that said you must provide transportation if you bring in four-year-olds. I'm wondering how you came to that decision, if you can recall it all, and just briefly.
Senator Johnson. Actually, we had run some pilots at one of our sites for a couple of years, and we were seeing some real good success. However, the attendance by some of the students was spotty, and frankly, it was a resource issue, Senator Johnson. We had some money that we got from a source for a year or two to support us in transportation, and our attendance pattern was pretty solid. Our results were pretty solid. That source dried up, so we tried to deliver it, thinking we could maybe reach more kids, use the money we had to reach more kids instead of investing in transportation. And the reality was that the children's attendance got to be so spotty that we didn't move them as far as we had in the past, and we were disappointed with those results and felt with the families that we were targeting who would most benefit from this, that the only answer for us is that the transportation, in essence, had to be a part of the picture for us to get the kind of progress we wanted with these kids. And so we made that decision. We found those resources to do that, and we have had those kind of results. Is that because of the support there, because some of these families are dealing with a questionable car, they don't have a car, people might not be getting up, those kinds of things or whatever. What was happening is attendance wasn't good. So we did that, it worked out well, and we've had attendance, we've had the transportation since then and just built it into our model. Why we can deliver it is to some degree the way our model is set up. We've got an AM and a PM shift of students who are coming in. We're able to dovetail on the front end of the school routes coming in, and the group going home at night has a dove. So I'm able to pay for that transportation in the middle of the day and do it in a fairly cost-effective fashion as a result. Each of my sites are about $15,000 roughly for it to run an AM-PM shift through. It's about when I dovetail on either end, it's about $15,000 for that transportation to get the kids there.
And Mr. Chair?
Senator Johnson.
And I'm sure there are many school districts and administrators that are doing that, similar things, but this is one that I've heard this statement made a couple of times, but I've never heard the explanation, so I appreciate it. Thank you.
Just a question on are the teaching requirements, are the licensure requirements for the educators that are teaching in the school readiness, are they the same as other educators? Do they have any special training? Or
Senator Stump, at least in our case, when we're going out to post for a position, we're looking for someone licensed in early education. That has that kind of background, so they know they've been through the kinds of training in which they know what a normal process of child development is and can recognize those things. One of the hidden factors with all of the early learning things, whether it's preschool screening, ECFE, school readiness, to some degree, one of the parts of those services that you may not see or appreciate as much is that all of those are serving as, if you will, kind of a filter to see these students. So that wherever they come into contact with the school district, if we see something that looks like it's not a child's not moving normally or developing normally, we can conference with parents and talk with them about the things we see and advise them as to options to assist their student in the learning process. And so that's some of the purpose of those programs, and that's some of why you look for those kinds of staff that are licensed in those arenas.
Okay, any other questions? Members, Senator Wieger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the excellent testimony. And again, look at these results. Yeah. And that is so impressive. Wilmer and other areas. And so I ask that we lay Senate File 155 as amended or lay it over for possible inclusion.
Yeah, on Senator Wieger's motion lay Senate File 155 over for consideration as amended. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. The motion is adopted. And next we have Senate File 442, Senator Wicklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am here today to present Senate File Number 442. It is a bill that would appropriate $100,000 in 2016 and $100,000 in 2017 for a grant to the Works Museum, which is a hands-on elementary engineering education program with exhibits. even if the museum wasn't in my district, I'd be very enthusiastic about this program because of the emphasis on the STEM fields, which I think is so important, and something that we need to be encouraging more children to get involved with science, technology, engineering, and math, and we need to do it at starting at the young ages, which is the focus of the works. So here today I have Brenda Rainey here, and she is going to present more information about the museum. I think you'll recall that last year we had them present and appropriated some money, a grant, last year, and she'd like to talk about their plans for the future.
Ms. Rainey, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair. Committee members, I'm Brenda Rainey, Senior Director of Development at the Works Museum. The Works Museum mission is to inspire the next generation of innovators, engineers, and problem solvers. And we do this by using the lens of engineering to engage all elementary age students in STEM. And I noticed Senator Wieger holding up our folder. I do encourage you to check that out. It's full of information about us.
Purple pride.
Exactly. We acknowledge right away that not all kids are going to grow up to be engineers, but we believe, and employers that we work with tell us, that all students benefit from the skills that are honed at the work, specifically persistence, collaboration, and creative problem solving. As you know, and as Senator Wicklund just referenced, with the support of this committee, we received an appropriation from the supplemental budget last year, and we used that funding to enhance and improve our Bloomington facility and programming. We made enhancements in our learning spaces. Nearly 30,000 elementary students and teachers from 89 different communities in Minnesota visited us last year, and we reached children from both the metro area and greater Minnesota. Our reach extended to communities from Alexandria to Onamia to Glencoe to Rochester, just to name a few. And the state's investment helped us make those learning spaces and environments more conducive and functional to our unique hands-on engineering-based programs. We improved our wayfinding, which is something that teachers and chaperones had been asking us for. We made our spaces brighter and more friendly for students. And we enhanced our graphic-based teaching tools that our STEM educators refer to periodically throughout all of our classes. We also enhanced our exhibit space. The state funds allowed us to begin working with an exhibit designer and other experts on how to use our space most effectively for learning by all of our audiences. We serve students from public, charter, private, independent schools. We serve families. We serve homeschool families. And these enhancements that we made led to new and improved exhibits and activities, some of which are on the floor now, others which will be on the floor before the start of our busy summer season. We improved our labels and our signage that we use to communicate and highlight engineering and STEM and increase exhibit understanding and engagement. And I'll make a point here that those labels aren't necessarily for the kids. The kids come in and they automatically know what to do with this stuff. They just start playing and having a great time. It's the parents who have to read the labels to see if they're doing it right. So we write those labels to make sure that those parents are feeling comfortable with what they're doing.
I wasn't sure of that.
And all of these actions are the first of a three-phase plan that's building on our 20 years of expertise in elementary engineering education so that we can be the leading provider of these experiences for all children. So I'm here today to request your support in continuing this work. The next phase of our plan calls to continue these improvements to increase our exhibit and programming relevance and value to our community. We listen to our audiences and we respond to their needs. And an example of that is last summer, we introduced a new summer camp program called Code Camp, which was all about computer coding, sequencing, and logic. And I thought to myself when we introduced this, what elementary student is going to want to do this? But I was wrong. We sold out the first two scheduled weeks of that camp. They were the fastest sellout we've ever had. We ended up adding three more weeks of Code Camp, all three of which sold out. This summer, we have Code Camp, we have Code Camp 2, and we have a special section of Code Camp just for girls to make sure that we are offering what our community is requesting. We're going to leverage what we do on-site and adapt it to bring to even more off-site locations within schools and communities throughout Minnesota. We visited more than 10,000 students in their schools and libraries around the state last year. We went to Duluth, we went to Northfield, we went to St. Cloud, we went to other locations as well. We've seen significant and momentum and growth over the last years. 5 years ago, 30,000 visitors came to the works, and last year we served nearly 75,000. And last year alone, we had 10% growth over the previous year. And a very important point I want to make is that the state appropriation that we received last year had ramifications far beyond your investment. That work has been favorably received by other funders, and we've been able to increase funding from individuals, from corporations, from foundations, because of the projects we were able to do with your seed funding, which is really how we see the state's investment, is seed funding to help us leverage and grow revenue from other sources. And I know you hear requests from many worthy programs, so I just want to take a couple minutes to talk about why we're unique. And the first reason is our focus on elementary age students. There's many programs for STEM that are available for older students, and that's wonderful, but we need to engage kids in STEM at a young age. Research from the U.S. Department of Education shows that interest in STEM goes from 57% in fourth grade to 30% by eighth grade. And that's when these kids are making decisions about their future, about their college major. We need to make sure that they are still excited about STEM. And we develop and build critical persistence and problem-solving skills through our programs. Our teachers like to say that we're the only place that encourages kids to fail, because that means they get to try again and they get to make it better. And this age of immediate answers from our smartphones and our iPads, kids don't have to try real hard. Things are coming pretty quickly, and when they're not, kids tend to give up. And so we're the place that says no, that persistence and that keeping on working is what you want to do and what we really encourage. And employers are telling us they appreciate that too, that many entry-level employees are coming in without those critical problem-solving skills that they need in their workforce. So we're a key component in the community pipeline that prepares today's children for tomorrow's jobs. Research from Wilder Research forecasts that STEM jobs just in Minnesota are going to grow by 18% by 2020 versus 13% in other fields. And these are jobs that are spread throughout the marketplace but have STEM as their common denominator. They grow faster, they pay better, they're good jobs that we want our kids to be ready for. So we work with formal education. All of our programs are standards aligned with Minnesota State Science Standards, and we offer these corollary experiences to engage and inspire elementary students to keep studying STEM. We look forward to partnering with the state on a funding package that will allow us to broaden and deepen our ability to provide students, teachers, and families across Minnesota these engaging STEM experiences. We are requesting, as it mentions in the one page in the purple folder, $100,000 a year for the next per year for the biennium to continue bringing these programs to Minnesota students. And our programs work. We've seen the kids that have started in our camps and in our classes 20 years ago grow up to be mathematicians and scientists and teachers. And we want to partner with the state to make this future a reality for more children. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rainey. Any questions from the committee members? Guess you explained it very well.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Wigger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to share, I had the privilege of visiting the works, and the students there were so actively engaged in all the experiences, a very enthusiastic staff. You're connecting well, and I know we have a number of opportunities throughout the state for students and as well as parents and grandparents and others that can be a part of that. And I can see why your program sells out very quickly for those summer camps, and it's right on for our objective for STEM.
Thank you.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, it is. I love this sort of thing because I think most kids say, why should I learn math? Why should I understand this? And when they get to experience the tangible things, then that encourages them to do the work that it takes in order to get to that point. So that's really kind of fun. How do you I've never heard of it before. And I would say I get around a fair amount and Google and read and take my grandkids to things, so I'm like, how have I missed this? So I'm sure you're available to everybody, but how do you get the word out?
Ms. Rainey?
Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, that's a great point, and that is actually something we have heard. A really brief history lesson. We have been around since 1995 when we were founded. We spent our early years actually in a nomadic existence in malls in the western suburbs and then settled down at the Edina Community Center in about 5,000 square feet of space there. 3 years ago, we moved to our current facility in Bloomington that has 40,000 square feet. And when we were in Edina, we were primarily a school group destination. And since moving to Bloomington, we have gone into more aggressively the public visitor side. We've expanded our camp opportunities exponentially, and the growth trajectory has really taken off from there. People are hearing more about us, but marketing is certainly a challenge for us right now, and one that we're seeing the results with that increased attendance, but we expect those numbers to continue to grow.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things, though, as soon as I saw this was a museum, I thought, oh, it's a museum. You just go look at things. And so I might have discounted it just because I would not have understood that it was an engaged the works, mm-hmm. not a flat Stanley kind of a thing mm-hmm. where you just look. So I think that just as a little feedback everything that may have caused me to say, well, I don't know if my kids want to go around and just stand around and look. They want to get in and do. So I wouldn't have understood sometimes. So the works is really great. The museum just kind of threw me a bit.
Thank you.
But thank you for being here. Now I found out.
If there's no other comments, Senator Wicklund?
Yes, I'd like to move Senate file number 442. I'd just like to say, I'm happy to support this bill because of the importance, I think, of encouraging children to go into STEM fields. I think that the early or the elementary approach is really important. I think their focus on not only students but also their families, and I think their outreach programs to teacher development, I think, is a unique area aspect as well, and I think that's important. They have a lot of outreach to provide professional development, which I think helps teachers become more comfortable teaching these subjects, which are sometimes maybe especially math can be more daunting, and I think it can be a great experience for elementary kids, and so we want to make teachers as comfortable as possible. So I'm very pleased to move this bill forward and recommend that it would be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus finance bill.
Senator Wicklund moves the Senate file 442 be laid over for possible inclusion in the education omnibus bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Ms. Rainey and Senator Wicklund. Senator Hoffman. And if we could have the testifiers join him at the table. Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 195. The proposal calls for an appropriation of $500,000 over the biennium to build the capacity of the Minnesota Council on Economic Education, also known as MCEE, another acronym to add to our list. Actually, they've been around since 1961, so its acronym's been a while, to provide essential professional development to teachers throughout the state, and especially in greater Minnesota. This training would be specific to economics and personal finance so that they're able to train their students to meet required economic and personal finance standards. The appropriation would be a one-time investment in the courses designed specifically for Minnesota teachers, aligned with our standards, and include instruction in effectively teaching these concepts to students. It would also fund the establishment of a master teacher corps that's going to build on the capacity of MCEE to provide face-to-face workshops in greater Minnesota and to bring the knowledge and experience of Minnesota's most accomplished economics teachers to train other teachers in effective classroom implementation on economics lessons. That is how to teach economics and personal finance so that students learn and retain these important concepts. No one questions, Mr. Chair and members, the need for Minnesota students to understand economics and personal finance. In fact, this body adopted new state academic standards for economics and personal finance in 2011. These new standards include benchmarks at each grade level, kindergarten through grade 8, and a semester course in high school. They're considered to be among the best economics standards in the nation. In our state, standards in personal finance fall within the economics standards. The challenge, however, is that many of Minnesota teachers are not adequately prepared to effectively instruct the students in these topics. Economics and personal finance are typically taught at a high school level by secondary social studies teachers. While Minnesota produces an abundance of teachers prepared in history, poli sci, geography, and other social sciences, only 2% of the secondary social studies teachers focused on economics in their undergraduate preparation. Yet high school social studies teachers can be and are often called upon to teach economics at any time. Our elementary teachers, who must now help their students meet economic and personal finance standards, typically have the very little training as well. Many of them have never taken even one college course in economics. MCEE is uniquely qualified to provide this professional development, and there is no other organization routinely providing this type of professional development for Minnesota teachers. In the testimony that follows, you're going to hear from a school district superintendent about the need for this service, particularly in greater Minnesota. Economics teacher who has been prepared by MCEE will relate her experience with MCEE on the professional development and how it positively affected her students. And finally, a business person who serves on the board of directors that will discuss the business community support for MCEE and its investment in teachers. So with me today are our Superintendent Chris Richardson from Northfield Public Schools. Let you know, Chris and I served many years ago on then Congressman Jim Ramsey economic or the education advisory committee he had. It's nice to get Chris to visit us back up north again to share his expertise, as well as Martha Rush, who's an educator with Mounds View High School, and then Tim Bodine, who's an economist with that small company called Cargill. You might have heard that one here in Minnesota. So welcome, Mr. Chair, and I send our testimonies to you.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. And, of course, Dr. Richardson's my boss in the fall until I get up here, and I teach – well, I taught economics for 9 years myself. I remember when our full-time high school economics teacher wanted to go to 8/10. No one wanted the economics 2/10 that he was teaching. I would have taken it, but not at the expense of civics or AP government. But it's a difficult area, and I'll try to be kind to you, Dr. Richardson, today. But, go ahead with your testimony.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, my name is Dr. Chris Richardson. I'm superintendent of schools in Northfield, Minnesota. I very proudly served on the board of the Minnesota Council on Economic Education, MCEE, for almost 2 decades. As we look at MCEE, it has really grown and expanded over a 50-plus year history. It's firmly committed to quality economics instruction in Minnesota. We really do believe in the transformational power of talented and dedicated teachers in shaping the lives of our young people. MCE's primary strategy is providing for the quality professional development of elementary and secondary teachers, many of whom have limited or no training in economics instruction. This is especially noticeable in Greater Minnesota. We believe this is an investment that we can make that keeps on giving for the future. MCE has implemented, I think, a unique public-private partnership, which includes both or all of the post-secondary expertise, K-12 teachers, and the business community in mutual support of economic literacy for Minnesota students. Since 1961, MCE has actually trained thousands of Minnesota teachers who, in turn, have positively affected the lives of probably millions of Minnesota students. Through the years, MCEE has worked with the Minnesota Department of Education to develop high-quality K-12 economic standards. We've also served, along with the department representatives, on the Minnesota Council for the Social Studies to facilitate the implementation of quality social studies standards, including those standards in economics. You bet. MCEE is focused on expanding economics and personal finance literacy, giving all of our teachers the skills they need to effectively teach the K-12 economic standards. Our concept is that by deploying a core of master teachers to expand our K-12 outreach capability, we can provide more impactful peer-to-peer learning using co-teaching with PhD instructors. We can create meaningful and relevant content, and we can leverage online technology. We believe in this way we can equip classroom teachers across Minnesota, whether they're in large schools, small schools, close to a university or college, or far away, with the skills and content and resources, economics, and personal finance that they can bring to bear directly on their classrooms. We very strongly believe that the quality professional development teaching economics is needed across the state, and especially in greater Minnesota, where teachers can't always access the Twin Cities for training. Finally, high-quality professional development in economics and personal finance using both face-to-face and online instruction provides great benefit for both teachers and students. We believe this is a win-win for our state and for our school districts that can provide a cadre of well-trained classroom teachers who can deliver high-quality economics K-12 and personal finance education to all the students in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Why don't we hear from all our testifiers, and then we'll see if there's any questions. Tim or Martha Rush, which Martha?
I'll be next, yes.
Ms.
Thank
Rush.
You. Thank you to the chair and the members of the committee. My name is Martha Rush, and I've been teaching at Moundsview High School in Arden Hills for 18 years. I started teaching economics in 2004, and like many, I hadn't taken a class in it since 1987. I was desperate for high-quality professional development. In 2006, after 2 years of seeking out information mostly on my own, as the only econ teacher in my building, I came across a postcard advertising a one-week course, what is now called Preparing to Teach High School Economics. That course was a complete lifesaver for me and for many other teachers in my situation. Professors Kurt Anderson of University of Minnesota Duluth and Agapitos Papagapitos from St. Thomas not only gave us a solid background in economic principles and theory, but also taught us how to teach economics. The MCEE promotes uniquely active learning strategies that have transformed economics from, I hate to say it, but sort of the boring class many of us remember from college, filled with widgets and graphs, into the most fun hour of the day. My students play Econoland, where they get to act out the circular flow diagram, acting as households and firms, first trading resources, and then trading for goods and services in a finished goods market. They play the market in wheat, where they act as buyers and sellers in a competitive market, and they actually get to see how equilibrium prices arise in a market. They do an activity called Why Do People Trade, where they get to trade first in small groups and then in larger groups to see how in a global economy more people can satisfy their needs and wants when they have more variety. I went on to take virtually every course that MCEE offered, and my students have reaped the benefits. I have many former students who are now getting PhDs in economics in places like Princeton, Columbia, and Berkeley. I have many students who have attended or are graduating, who are attending now or have graduated from the Carlson School of Business. I can't tell you how many of them have told me that econ was their favorite class in high school. My student teams have competed at the National Econ Challenge Finals and the Harvard Pre-Collegiate Economics Challenge, holding their own against schools like Phillips Academy and Choate. My older son, a product of my classes, is now an econ and math major at Dartmouth. Not only is the MCE's professional development and economics key, but they also offer courses and incredible resources to help us teach personal finance, which, as we all know, is an incredibly important subject today. Thanks to the MCEE, students are learning the importance of saving and budgeting, the power of compound interest, and the importance of building their own human capital. The MCE offers the best staff development, bar none, and I'm now proud to be able to give back as a presenter and teacher in many of these programs. Just last week in St. Cloud, I presented a lesson that I co-wrote called Earning Credit, which encourages math teachers to actually teach about credit scores and interest rates when they teach compound interest. On Saturday, I led a workshop for teachers in the Duluth area, showing them how to use the Econoland game as well as an unemployment survey activity and other simulations in their classrooms. Every year, more social studies and business teachers are assigned to teach econ for the first time, and many of them are fearful because they don't feel prepared. Thankfully, the Minnesota Council for Economic Education continues to be there for them, and I want to thank you for supporting this incredibly valuable program. Before I leave, I'd like to share a few comments I received unsolicited from teachers who attended our programs this summer and fall. From one Minneapolis teacher, "I am so impressed with what you guys do. I love the high school economics book you gave out at the MPS training you did. I used it almost every day for the rest of the semester, and it was great. The kids loved it." from a teacher at UBA Medical Academy. Thank you for the great learning experience this summer. I've worked hard out on an island by myself for 3 years to make my econ curriculum, but within a matter of months in this class, I was able to better fill missing pieces in my curriculum and gain new ideas how to teach concepts in engaging ways. And from a teacher in Delano, I thought the summer workshop was incredibly useful and fun. I'm now actually excited to teach econ, not just begrudgingly grateful for any social studies job in Minnesota. Thank you.
Senator Hoffman, you didn't have breakfast this morning? Thank you, Ms. Rush.
I saved one for you.
Mr. Bowden?
Yes, good morning. I'm honored to be here with you. I've given many, many presentations, but it's the first time I've spoken into a committee of government, so I'm very honored to be here with you. I'm representing MCEE. I'm representing my employer, Cargill, and last but not least, I'm representing my own personal views as a board member on MCEE. I've worked at Cargill for 36 years, most all of that as an economist, doing forecasting to help Cargill locate good investments internationally. I've been on the MCE board for about 9 years. I was chair for a couple of years, currently lead our long-range planning committee. I believe very strongly in the MCE vision to empower youth with knowledge to be successful citizens. At MCE, we don't teach abstract ideas that will never be used. We teach critical thinking skills that are drawn on daily in adult life, whether that be how to invest in one's skills to maximize income and payback, or how to be an effective employee by creating value, or how to manage the financial affairs of oneself or one's family, or finally, how as citizens to collectively manage scarce public resources for maximum societal gain. We are bringing these critical thinking skills to tomorrow's parents, workers, voters, and leaders. The approach is to impact the lives of students mainly by stimulating their teachers with knowledge. I support this effort strongly as a committed citizen. My employer, Cargill, has supported MCEE continuously for more than 50 years since its inception. We are not alone in this support. Other large organizations, such as General Mills, 3M, and the Minneapolis Fed, have also continuously supported MCEE, and we have many other individual and organizational supporters. We get strong support in kind by coordinating and integrating efforts from the University of Minnesota and from other secondary institutions in Minnesota. Yes, of course, we as supporters have our own self-interest to build an informed society of successful individuals, whether these are consumers, workers, voters, or leaders. But in my view, our main driver is we want to give as we have received in our own youth. We want to boost the lives of the young as we were boosted by our own teachers and our parents in our youth. So how do we do this boosting work at MCEE, and why are we here? You've heard of our cumulative impact. Chris mentioned millions. In fact, it's 2 million. Over 2 million young Minnesotans over 51 years have been exposed to our programming. That's huge cumulatively, but we think we can do a lot more annually with additional leverage of technology, bringing our content to teachers rather than bringing the teachers to us, and by training more trainers in a kind of extension outreach model. I'd like to use a Microsoft analogy to explain just a bit. Microsoft built its first copy, its first CD of Windows NT, which was the predecessor for all of the subsequent operating systems, for $500 million, roughly, and then they distributed that $500 million CD at a cost of $1 per copy. We've built a great creative product at MCEE, almost like software. We've already invested in and paid for the product. Now we need to lever up our distribution at $1 a copy, so to speak. As a private contributor to MCEE and representing strong local organizations like Cargill, who have and will continue to contribute, we believe we can and will sustain MCE's ongoing operations. But we ask for your temporary and targeted support, one time, to help us build our capacity to leverage our distribution. One final comment. I frankly didn't know where else to fit this in. We all hear a lot about the achievement gap, and it frustrates all of us, including you, I'm sure. I believe MCE is all about narrowing the achievement gap, both in school and in life. We have a point of access to students through teachers where we bring ideas which are directly relevant to day-to-day life and hence are motivating and engaging. With respect to gaps, we are reassessing the footprint of our impact to make sure we deliver to all communities and that we do not overlook communities where the knowledge is least and therefore the impact payback can be the most. We can change lives with a program that everyone can support. I mentioned at the outset that my job is to identify good investments for Cargill. I think this is an excellent investment for the state of Minnesota. Please help us with this important work. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bowden. Before, I know Senator Johnson has one question. You know, when I got my social studies degree for teaching in the 80s in Iowa, I had to emphasize three areas, and economics was not one of them. But when I got my teaching license in Minnesota, I could teach all social studies. Do you think our higher education, do you think our colleges and universities, maybe Ms. Rush or Mr. Richardson, do you think they're, what does a social studies major look like in terms of economics education for having those teachers ready in our classrooms right now?
I think Ms.
Rush?
I think that social studies majors have quite a bit of freedom to make choices about which things they want to specialize in. And I can say, as someone who's had a number of students go on to study econ, I think economics tends to be a little bit more like chemistry and math in that people who do major in econ find that they have many, many, many opportunities in the workforce. Like I said, my own son is an econ major. He's going to work for Morgan Stanley this summer. He's not planning to be a teacher. And I think we really have to work on building the econ knowledge in social studies teachers we have, because econ majors tend to think less, I think, about teaching, unfortunately.
Thank you. Mr. Richardson.
Mr. Chair, I guess the only other piece I would share with this is, again, with the focus of this program, we're really looking K-12. Our standards are K-12. Mm-hmm. We need to be presenting opportunities to support our elementary teachers as well as our secondary teachers. And since secondary teachers are really the only ones that are certified in economics specifically, which are very few, or more generally in social studies, we have a number of social studies teachers that may have only taken one course mm-hmm. in economics during their undergraduate degree. And obviously, elementary teachers and most middle school teachers will have taken no courses in economics as part of the degree. So the real focus here is providing direct support to all of our teachers K-12 so that they have the skills to teach economics concepts and personal finance, which we really believe are pivotal and key skill sets that all students should have as they move into the world of work.
Thank you. Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and probably to, well, any one of the testifiers. First of all, I consider economics drives all of our decisions here at the Capitol, so I think we all have to be ready with economics. But I, for some reason, kept this article that was brought to me by a person that I don't have the name of, but this paper that I have in front of me is about the Minnesota GPI. Have you ever heard of that? It's the Genuine Progress Indicator, and it really talks about the well-being of the state and how you count that in your economics. Are you familiar with that? I wondered if it's a hoax or if it's something real. Let me just add that I have told many, many people, including my family, that this place is a wonderful place because I get to ask the best experts in the state of Minnesota questions that are probably kind of silly or maybe don't really make a lot of sense, but I can still do it, and I appreciate that very much.
That's a fair question. I have not heard of that specific indicator, that measure, but there are people who have tried to advance economics to say part of our measures of well-being are not captured by measures like GDP. They're measuring things like the happiness index, for instance.
Yes.
They are saying that if an individual can't earn roughly, I think it's $80,000 for a household, then you generally, they've surveyed and found people are generally struggling and unhappy, and beyond that. So there are these subjective measures like that, and economics is increasingly going into those, but it's a very soft area that's not very deep yet.
And Mr. Chair, if I might make a final comment, and
Senator Johnson,
time is limited, but when I got my master's degree, and for some of you may know it, that I got an award from the foundation, that I was able to go to Harvard. And I remember when I had that economics class, and I questioned about, because they were teaching me about economics, and I was wondering why they don't count all of the women who stay home and take care of their children as part of our economic, gross domestic product. And the professor basically put me down, and I didn't like it. Thank you. Thank you for...
Senator Botthoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first, just a follow-up to Senator Johnson's comment. I met with that same gentleman, Kent Patel was his name, and this particular theory, and I would love you to take a look at it and see what you think, but it talked about things like that if we are making more of something that we don't need, that in fact, while it may look like our GDP is greater, if it's what we're making is going to do the planet harm, then it should be counted as a negative. And this gentleman was asserting that this new measure is being used in Europe. I've not ever seen that. I found it interesting, but I did want to hear other economists' view on that. So I'd love to have you get this article and share your comments. But also, I just wanted to acknowledge that Tim is my constituent and how much I enjoyed our time this, past fall, where I got to hear about your work and was really surprised at just how long it's been around and how much great impact you're having that I hadn't realized. So thank you very much for your leadership and for taking the time to let me know about it. And thanks, Senator Hoffman, for carrying the bill.
I think Senator Weber and then Senator Kiffmeyer, then I think we need to keep moving.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since I had told Senator Hoffman I was saving all my tough questions for him today, I thought it was important I at least had something to say. But anyway, I also want to say, though, I do agree with the concept that we obviously need to have more and better economics training into the system. But to piggyback on what you were referring to, Mr. Chairman, it seems to me, though, we are at a point where, as I think back to my high school career, it was either the social studies teacher, maybe even some instances the math teacher, that always dealt with, at some point in time, a unit about personal finances, about some of the basics, and that if we really aren't having a teaching staff that is ready to go, that is fully comfortable in that as they get out of college, I think there are deficiencies elsewhere that we need to be concerned about. In that respect, and because it is so vitally important. And as Senator Johnson said, we certainly should be dealing with a lot of economics here in this body. Sometimes I'm not sure we follow economic principles as we pursue different things, but it is something that we do need to keep in mind.
Thank you, Senator Weber. And Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I really appreciate hearing this bill and hearing all three of you in your testimony. Both from the teacher and mom perspective, as well as business and so on. So I really appreciate that. It's impressive. I just also think, though, that when you have a board of teaching and we have teachers graduating, I think we need to take care of today, like you talk about, the teachers of today, the need today. But I also think we need to do more with our teachers who are coming out of the teaching colleges, that they get this there so we don't have to do that. I think we need to work at both. So one of my questions is, do you work at both with current teachers, and are you also involved in the teaching colleges to make this a program there as well? And then another question is the total budget for MCEE. What is your total budget? Because all I see here is a smaller picture. And is this $250,000 per year? Has there been any previous state aid, or is this the only time you've come to the state and asked for money other than the tremendous support of your other support of donors? Those are three big questions, I know. But
Ms. Rush.
I'm just going to take on the first question, if that's okay. We have definitely branched out just in the past year, actually, to trying to address more to reach pre-service teachers as well as teachers who are already in the classroom. And we're actually planning to offer a course for the first time this summer, a two-day course for pre-service teachers. I was able to teach one class period at the University of Minnesota, but I've also been in contact with other schools and really trying to because I think even if we improve the level of economics instruction required of new teachers, being able to get out there and teach the methods, the active learning strategies on how to make econ an exciting, engaging course, I think is really important. So that is definitely one of the goals with increasing the master teacher program and the outreach of the council.
Okay. Thank you. And Senator Kiffmeyer, actually, Mr. Arneson has maybe an answer to your second question.
Okay. Right.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer members, and as you asked your question, I was looking at the financial statements for the council on their website. And point of information, in 2014, their total expenditures were about $916,000. I don't believe, Mr. Wilms can correct me, I don't believe that the state has, the legislature has made a previous contribution.
Senator Kiffmeyer, not within the education area, but I can't speak to other areas such as higher education.
Okay. Mr. Bowden has a follow.
Yeah, answer. I would just add one comment about the budget. We have roughly $450,000 of cash contributions per year, cash that we generate, and then we've got roughly an equivalent amount in kind from the University of Minnesota and from other institutions around the state. So I think we actually operate on a shoestring budget. When I see the kind of spending we have in Cargill and then look at the impact for the dollars, it's quite significant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that's exactly my point. Is goes to show that efficient use of resources, which is sound economics, it's nice to see it not only being taught, being lived in regards to your own work, and want to just commend you for that.
Well, who knew economics could be so exciting and such a robust discussion? Senator Hoffman, if you want to give the final word and a motion, would be great.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you. You know, just to highlight, there have been over 37,000 teachers that have experienced the training from this program in the state of Minnesota. And Mr. Bodine was saying, the University of Minnesota has been a partner since 1992. So there's a lot of collaboration that's going on. And speaking of the University of Minnesota, Kent Patel was at the University of Minnesota and a former board member of MCEE, just to put that out there. So with that, Mr. Chair and members, I would like to see Senate file 195 be passed and laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Or is it 766?
Senator,
got two different numbers here, Mr. Chair.
We're going to go by 195, I think.
I'm going to go by 195. Thank you for the clarification.
Senator Hoffman moves that Senate file 195 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, testifiers. Thank you, Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you.
And Senator Kent. Welcome, Senator Kent, and I see Senator Nelson, someone who graced our committee the year before. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, members. I'm really glad to have Senator Nelson back here with us this morning, particularly on a project of love that we both share great enthusiasm about. So we are here this morning to talk about Senate File 607. Senator Nelson and I serve on the board for Serve Minnesota, and so we have the opportunity to spend additional time diving into a lot of the details about this amazing program that has been so tremendously successful in educating our students and helping to achieve that critical milestone of third grade literacy that we've been talking about quite a bit this morning. As a matter of fact, when we think about the world's best workforce and the five parameters that that make that up, three of them are really solidly addressed by this amazing program. Kindergarten readiness, third grade literacy, and then the achievement gap. And we've seen great results, and this committee has seen a number of those results in recent months as well. And going back to Senator Kiffmeyer's comments on the previous bill, I think we're continuing the theme. It's about bang for the buck. It's about doing an awful lot of good and making tremendous progress within limited resources. And so it is because of that success that we are here today to try to expand our commitment to this proven program. The Minnesota Reading Corps is an evidence-based reading intervention program that is working with over 30,000 struggling readers in more than 700 schools and pre-K programs this school year. Despite these numbers, the demand from our schools and programs exceed the funding that we do have available. For the coming school year, schools and pre-K programs requested 1,665 full-time Reading Corps members, and that compares with 1,050 FTEs this year. This bill attempts to help meet some of that demand. Senate File 607 would provide an additional $10 million over the biennium and will allow Minnesota Reading Corps to reach 14,000 additional struggling readers over the next 2 years. This program is unique. It is a private-public partnership with corporations and foundations partnering with state and federal governments to fund these efforts. We're fortunate to have strong private support. This year, private funders will provide $2.1 million, with much of this funding earmarked for St. Paul, Minneapolis, and Bloomington schools. Federal AmeriCorps funding provides $13.7 million in program funding and $5.9 million in education award for AmeriCorps members to use to buy down student debt or continue their schooling. And our state appropriation is used largely to provide the federal required matching funds that are needed for programs in greater Minnesota and suburban communities. And as I mentioned, this program gets results. Because they record progress monitoring data weekly and conduct benchmarks assessments 3 times annually, Reading Corps ensures the specific interventions are helping accelerate student literacy attainment. With the support of a licensed teacher as an internal coach and ongoing support and training from a master coach, Reading Corps members review individual student data regularly to ensure students are making necessary progress. And finally, the training Reading Corps members receive and the experience they get makes them valued by schools and pre-K programs. We keep talking about the teacher shortages and the needs to attract really passionate, qualified people into our students' classrooms, and this is one that's working. 60% of all Reading Corps members surveyed say they are now considering a job in education. So with that introduction, I'd like to welcome Senator Nelson and her comments.
Oh, thank you so much, Senator Kent. Well, I feel like I'm coming home. It is great to be back here in this room with you and this committee and the good work that you do. And I'm so happy that Senator Kent has brought this bill forward. We've done so before in the past, and I'm actually really glad that she asked me to come and share a few words about the Minnesota Reading Corps. You know, this is a Minnesota-grown and designed program, and it is working. It is working because of all the reasons that Senator Kent said, and I don't want to take the thunder from our next testifier who's going to share the results with you. But some of you will remember sitting around this very table probably, I'm thinking it was 4 years ago when we first had the Reading Corps in after our first appropriation increase to them. And they talked about what they were seeing, which was a lessening of special education referrals. And those of us on education, our ears all picked up because we know how education referrals impact school budgets. And so what you're going to hear today is the matched research that shows how the Reading Corps has really impacted the number of students who actually are referred for special education. And you'll hear the results. What have worked, you're also going to hear about we're really short. We have more who want this program. I'm guessing it's in most of your districts. If you haven't had a chance to visit, it's phenomenal to visit one of your schools where they're actually doing this. But let me just say, it's a program that works. It's great that it's private and publicly funded, and the funds that we put in at the state are matched more than a 2-to-1 by the feds. So it's a win-win-win all the way around, and I look forward to being refreshed on the new research. But I think this is one of the key things that we can do to make sure all kids are reading at grade level by grade 3. And when Senator Kent and I did a little presentation at the National Conference of State Legislatures, as legislators from across the nation came and visited some of our reading core sites, it was very interesting to talk to legislators from other states who are also working at trying to expand reading core in their states. So our successful evidence-based program is working, and it's being replicated across the nation. And so, again, thank you for your consideration. I think this is one of the finest things we can do to make sure all of our students are reading on grade level. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. And are we ready for Mr. Heistad?
Mr. Chair and Senators, my name is David Heistad. I'm Executive Director of Research at Bloomington Public Schools, and before that I was in Minneapolis Public Schools for 25 years. I'm going to briefly summarize a study that was conducted in Minneapolis before I moved to Bloomington. On page 2 of the handout, you'll see an overview of the study. Basically, what we did was we found a matched comparison for every single student in K-3 reading core. We found another student that had similar prior test scores and demographics to create a comparison group. So this is a scientific method for determining the causal impact of programs. And in this case, instead of looking at test scores, we looked at what's the probability that a student would be in special ed the next year. And we go through the handout details, the matching procedures, the demographics. I'll just briefly mention that over 80% of the students in the study were free and reduced price lunch, and more than half of the students were students of color. When you look at the overall effectiveness, it turned out that students that were not in reading core, the matched sample, were 2.5 times more likely to be in special ed the next year than the students that had reading core. And I did this research in collaboration with former Commissioner of Education Bob Wadle, who estimated what would be the cost savings to schools in Minnesota. You'll see at the bottom of page 6 on slide 12, if you extrapolated the findings from Minneapolis to all the districts in Minnesota, the savings to districts would be approximately $9 million a year. So this is a study that adds to the research evidence. There are a number of prior studies that are mentioned on page 7 where we've used these kinds of scientific studies to show that students who receive reading core have better test scores, higher proficiency levels in third grade, and a much stronger growth in pre-literacy skills. So from pre-K all the way up to grade 3, reading core has been substantiated by a number of studies. The most recent study is at the bottom of that slide, where the University of Chicago came in as an independent research organization and found that the impact for reading core was huge. Basically, they report their findings in terms of standard deviation units. Typically, if you make a third of a standard deviation growth with your students, you've made substantial growth. They reported standard deviations approximately 0.7. So about 2 times what would be considered moderate growth in the national research. The impact is the greatest at pre-K, K, and 1. There is substantial impact at 2 and 3, too, but those early ages are most impacted by the program. And so I won't go into any further detail, so we can hear from our colleagues who are actually doing the work.
Thank you, Mr. Heistad. And for the other testifiers, we are very short on time. Might you maybe all come up and just take a moment? I know it puts a little pressure on you to kind of compress your testimony that you've worked so hard to come with, but we want to be sure we at least get a few words from each of you, and then identify yourself for the record, please.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Carrie Reardon, and I'm a reading specialist at Middleton Elementary School in Woodbury, Minnesota. One of the biggest issues facing Middleton is the number of our students that do need support in order to become fluent readers. Minnesota Reading Corps has given us that extra support and continues to give us extra support. They have a tested model, and it allows us to serve more children and understand and know that we will get good results. I'd like to tell you a little bit about Samuel. First, Samuel started working with our tutor, Callie, who's here today. He was very shy. He was embarrassed. He didn't know if he really wanted to do this reading thing. So he started working with Callie, and within a couple weeks, they had built a solid relationship working one-on-one. We have seen his academic skills grow, and most importantly, for him, his confidence is growing. So he can now extend his own academics and continue to receive some support from Callie. Reading Corps also benefits the tutors that work in the program. Reading Corps has an outstanding training and coaching model to support these tutors. I have seen the tutors come from many different walks of life, and this year of service or 2 years of service that they provide, they have time to develop the ideas about what they'd like to do next in their life. And I have seen two of my previous tutors decide to go into education. They have completed their master's degrees and are working in education. In addition, our current tutor, Callie, is finishing up her master's degree right now, which she started after completing her first year of service. She loved working with children and wanted to go into teaching. And she plans to be doing her student teaching at Middleton Elementary next year. So, and then a third area that I have seen working as an internal coach, I've worked both in pre-K and in the elementary setting. And especially in the pre-K setting, I have seen how Minnesota Reading Corps tutors impact the classroom teachers. Over the years in Minnesota, preschool has changed their focus from teaching developmental skills, social skills, to adding in a lot of academic skills to prepare our students for kindergarten. Teachers that have been in the classroom for many years may not have all of this new training. So Minnesota Reading Corps brings that new training to them, and I have seen the academic focus in the classrooms increase greatly. Just in conclusion for you, I want to let you know that Middleton Elementary really needs more, you know, Minnesota Reading Corps tutors in our building. We have so many students that would benefit. We have enjoyed having our tutors, and we love having Minnesota Reading Corps in our building. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our next testifier, and again, we're very short on time, but for the record, start with your name and your title, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Plotichuk, and I am the principal at Middleton Elementary. We have 800 students in our K-5 building. Prior to that, I was a principal at Webster Elementary and Carver Elementary in North St. Paul Maplewood District. Through 6 years of experience working with the Reading Corps, I have seen the impact it has made on our students, our families, our teachers, and our program. One of the biggest impact is the increased student literacy levels. We know that early literacy and early intervention is the key to student success. I have the pleasure of visiting classrooms daily, and one of the things that is really important that I've noticed is that daily one-on-one intense, purposeful instruction that impacts the students as they then transition into the classroom. Students are engaged in their learning, and what I've noticed as a huge impact of our program, as the students' participation rate increases in the classroom, they feel comfortable being part of discussions, they're reading aloud, and they're willing to take risks. Another piece that's unique to the program is that coordination, the collaboration, coordination amongst the teacher, the parent, the coach. It takes a village to really make the program successful, the uniqueness that goes into it. But we know the students' needs because of the data collection that is done daily, weekly. Students are tracked on a trend line. They buy into this. They get to track their own data and see what is working and what is not and what they can do differently. I'm a former reading recovery teacher, and I've seen the strategies implemented with Reading Corps at a higher level. Being at a large building site at Middleton, we have 493 kindergarten through third grade students, which 110 of them are below grade level. They're at-risk learners. We have one full-time Reading Corps member. We are not reaching all of our students. The results are clear, and the support that it provides is hand down the best intervention I've seen in a long time. It is inspiring to watch the positive impact Reading Corps has had on the students and our community at Middleton Elementary. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate that. And now it appears as though we have an actual alumna here today. That's really exciting to be able to hear from you. And Ms. Davis, please state your name, though, for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Hannah Davis, and I was a Reading Corps tutor for the 2013-14 school year. I serve students at Highwood Hills Elementary in St. Paul. After I graduated from St. Olaf, I thought that I might want to become a teacher, so I became a Reading Corps tutor to gain some more experience in elementary school before heading off to graduate school. I think it was a great way to be part of a school community. I think Reading Corps is really unique because it enables you to have that one-on-one instructional time with kids, which helps you meet them exactly where they are, and they don't have to compete for attention, and they can really focus. There's also a high demand for that extra literacy instruction that helps set up kids for future success in their school career. Reading Corps teaches kids that don't qualify for special ed, and so, yeah, you can see students go from recognizing letter sounds to reading stories in the span of a year, and they themselves can see that progress, and so it helps build their confidence about school and their school identity. I'm finding that Reading Corps has also prepared me in becoming a special education teacher because it gave me practice in implementing research-based interventions and charting students' progress. In addition, this program allows children to have a meaningful relationship with an adult who they see for 20 minutes every day. And so having this consistency can be an important part of their day and their sense of self. I'm grateful for my service with Reading Corps, the students I was able to support, and how my experience has set me up for success as a teacher and reinforced my commitment to helping my community.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Davis. And Senator Kent, if you would like to close, or if the members have any additional questions, but as you note, we're already late, so might want to expedite this a bit.
I'll be glad to expedite this. This is one of the most important bills that can be funded this year. We're asking for $10 million over the biennium. We're going to have budget discussions here. I will tell you, this bill works. It leverages dollars, and it helps kids be successful readers. I'm a former reading teacher, a reading specialist, actually, and I've seen this work. It has all the elements of a successful reading intervention, and I again thank you for the opportunity, Senator Kent. Thank you for carrying this, and I'll just add one other thing. Reading Corps for ages 3 to grade 3, so it really dovetails in with the early childhood, making sure that all kids are prepared for kindergarten when they get there. So again, it's a great bill. I hope the committee is successfully looking at this, and I would say in your packets, look at page 6 and 7. The top two slides say it all. That's all you need to see. Thank you so much. Thank you, Senator Kent.
Thank you, Senator Nelson, for being here. And I'll just wrap up very briefly by saying that if all we do is achieve these goals of kindergarten readiness and reading at grade level at grade 3, we've done an amazing thing. But you've heard the many different ways that there's just so much additional topspin in terms of recruiting new teachers and spreading these techniques throughout schools and helping all the students. So this really is just an amazing opportunity for our kids. So with that, I would like to move that Senate file, here we go, 607, be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you very much, Senator Kent and Senator Nelson. I've noticed our committee usually goes till 10:30, but I noticed today there has an 11 o'clock time on it. So I was going on what we were usually doing on the 10:30, and we had a little bit more time than I thought. So that's really nice because this is such an important subject, and glad to hear from all of you. Members, do you have any questions before we take action? Since I'm not at my chair, I guess we can proceed. Okay. All those in favor of laying over for possible inclusion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and it is laid over.
Susan.
Senator Kent, it sounds like you have another bill.
You have another bill, yes.
Okay, Senator Kent, if you're ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. I feel really lucky this morning. I get to talk about a couple of really special things that are working well in the state of Minnesota. And so for this one, we're talking about the Minnesota Children's Museum. Senate File 447 will help expand some of the great work that is done being done by the Children's Museum throughout Minnesota. Everyone knows, especially anyone who's a parent or a grandparent or had the chance to take a kid to the Children's Museum here in St. Paul or in Rochester or any of the other sites, and we'll come back to that in a minute, just how terrific it is and what a treasure it is. It's consistently listed in the top 10 children's museums in the nation. In a number of magazines, you'll see some information about that. And as I mentioned, it is statewide. You're all receiving this folder, and on the back you'll see the maps that show membership and where school groups come from. But my favorite is the one with the dots, and you can see the two museums and the smart play spots that are located at facilities throughout the state, and then the tours that they do. So they really make a tremendous effort to do outreach for kids throughout the state. And what the Children's Museum does, you know, it looks like all fun and games, but play ultimately is learning. It is a significant part of a child's development. It benefits the whole child across social, cognitive, physical, and emotional domains. And, you know, we spend a lot of time both here and in the Higher Education Committee and workforce discussions talking about the need for our students not to just be able to do the fundamentals of math and reading, but to bring a lot of the soft skills into their lives with them. And so this helps plant those very critical seeds. Minnesota Children's Museum is committed to sparking children's learning through play, and it empowers parents to support playful learning in the home. Senate File 447 appropriates $500,000 each year to the Minnesota Children's Museum as a pass-through from the Department of Education. This is a $480,000 increase from the current appropriation, and it is very worth pointing out, I think, that the Children's Museum funding has not had an increase since 1997. That is 18 years. So for those who have kids somewhere near college age, that puts it in perspective. It's been a while. They do a great job with a lot of funding sources and relatively little from the state. But by making this expansion, we'll allow the Children's Museum to deepen their service, which is already significant, to underserved families who are most at risk for education and health disparities. And they will innovate in parent education. That's one of the things that I thought was sort of most interesting when I've had a chance to visit with the team from the Minnesota Children's Museum, that opportunity to really show parents what they can take back home with them, and then they continue to reinforce those lessons. They leverage this partnership with the University of Minnesota and broaden that reach among parents. They disseminate that research on play and serve a bridge between that research and families. And then they've created a pilot program called Text to Learn, which sends out sort of helpful hints to parents through text messages on things, ideas of ways you can integrate play into your kid's day that has learning benefits. And so they want to scale that up, and this is one of the programs that would be expanded. So having said that, I will let Diane Krizan, am I saying that right? I apologize, who is the president of the Minnesota Children's Museum, speak in greater detail.
Thank you very much, Senator Kent and Ms. Krizan. For the record, again, your name and your organization, please.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair, Senators. I'm Diane Krizan, president of Minnesota Children's Museum. And Senator Kent spoke very well about how play is learning, and that isn't necessarily obvious to everyone. I could quote a lot of different research studies about that, research studies about how play helps children develop executive functioning skills, kind of wiring the prefrontal part of their brain that that then is linked to kindergarten readiness. I can talk through how playing with blocks establishes those early kind of spatial learning skills that are helpful for math. I could talk about a lot of research studies, but I do just want to put a point on just one research study that we highlight in a circle in one of the callouts in the brochure that's kind of controversial if you look at it. And it's a study that was done in Jamaica that was published in the journal Science last year. And it reads sort of controversial because compares children. So for 20 years, researchers were looking at a group of malnourished children in Jamaica. And there was a group that was the control group, so remained malnourished. There was a group that received extra food to address their needs there. And then there was a group that received a play intervention. So for once a week, for 2 years, somebody came into the homes of the young children and taught the parents how, for 1 hour, how to play with their child to foster their early development. Fast forward 20 years later, and it was the group that had received the play intervention that had higher IQ, higher college admission, higher income, so really performed better in school and set them up for life. What's controversial is I am in no way saying everybody knows every child should be well-fed and well-nourished. None of us are going to debate that. It's just not – what's shocking is to realize how much play really is the way – it's food for the brain. It really helps children develop across all the domains that Senator Kent was speaking of. So we do have our logic model listed in your brochure that speaks to the seven, what we call our seven C's, but seven 21st century skills that are developed through play. But I'll spare you talking about all the research that's associated with that. You know, as Senator Kent mentioned, the appropriation we've received from the state has stayed flat for 18 years. We use that appropriation primarily to help with our free and reduced admission so the doors stay open to children regardless of means to be able to pay to go to the museum. So that includes a sliding fee based on the free and reduced population. That includes doing free nights where we open up the museum to Head Start programs and other community groups that serve lower socioeconomic status families so that they have a chance to put the museum in their context and understand what is this all about? Why would I want to come to a museum when they see the hands-on learning, see the joy in their children, engage with their children themselves? We also have a free admission program that provides an unlimited membership, the same access as our paid membership for families that are at 130% of the poverty level below a free membership. Since this appropriation started in 97, we had 342 families receive that free membership. We now have more than 3,000 families every year. That reaches more than 9,000 children. So with an increased appropriation, what we would like to do is to be able to grow this free and reduced admission program as the Children's Museum grows. Thanks to the state of Minnesota, we're on the in a capital investment package that was passed last session. We're on the verge of growing again. We want to be able to maintain our commitment to having 25% of our audience come through that free and reduced admission program, and an increase in the appropriation would help with that. We want to be able to innovate with parent education. We have a relationship with the Institute of Child Development at the University of Minnesota. Dr. Megan Gunner, the director there, chairs a research advisory council for the museum. We just had a meeting last night with the council, so it's fresh in my mind of the advice they're giving us on the best and latest research that's out there. We can act as the dissemination arm to parents, reaching into the homes of parents of children from birth through 10 years old is our target audience with that, and to really complement all the great work that is happening in the school system by being able to directly reach parents. The Text to Learn program is one example of that. There's a box call out on the lower right there that just speaks to the University of Minnesota was our evaluation partner. We had a control group. We had an intervention group, pre- and post-tests. And for 3 months, we piloted the use of text messages as a way to get information about how to play with your child to develop literacy skills in the home. and there was a statistically significant increase in literacy behaviors in the home over just 3 months of getting some reminders and some tips through text messaging. So it's just a really powerful opportunity to expand that to a breadth of different activities, expand it beyond 3 months, expand it beyond just the 50 families that received that intervention. And then the opportunity to be able to customize that, recognizing the diversity of our families that are lower income and could benefit from this. And so we would want to be able to accomplish that as well, too, to make sure we reach all families appropriately. So thanks for your consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Krizan. And I have been to the Children's Museum with my grandkids, and it was really fun, and it was very crowded. So I would expect your expansion of your facility is probably good as well. Mm-hmm. Members, any questions? Okay. Seeing then, we'll lay this over for possible inclusion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and it is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Ms. Kent.
Thank
Senator
you.
Kent and Ms. Krizan. And with that, Mr.
Yes,
Chair.
Madam Chair, that completes our business, and the remaining items for this week are listed on the back of the agenda. And by the end of the week, we should have more postings for the next few weeks.
All right. With that, we are adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sign up then. It's very, too.